Good afternoon, my conscious co-creators. Welcome to another edition of the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. I am very, very pleased, as always, that you are here with me today. We have another fascinating show in store for you today. One I'm really looking forward to interviewing my guest and talking about this topic. One of my favorite topics. But first, of course, we have my blog post from a couple of years ago. So let's get started with that so I can get to my guest as soon as possible. All right. So today's blog post is entitled Context Makes Everything Clearer. We all make stories about our lives, and we create tremendous meaning from those stories. Our history and our experience colors all of these stories, to the point that we are convinced all these stories are true. We are so sure that they happened exactly the way we remember. Yet we are confused as to why people acted the way they did, or why they said what they said. When we get so focused on the details, we can miss the point. We can lose the lesson to learn because we are only seeing things from a limited perspective. If we take the time to remember the context, the content can make much more sense. New patterns emerge before our eyes. A deeper understanding can be achieved when there are more details to fill in the background. The context gives us a clearer framework with which to see a situation. Whether the instance was long ago in our childhood or yesterday at the grocery store, even remembering that the situation happened in a store or at home can make a big difference. The setting, the time, what happened before and after, it all makes a huge impact on the meaning we derive from the situation. It can help us see patterns where there were none before. Or it can help see new or different patterns than what we thought. And when we discuss these situations, it is also helpful to see how things have changed since the situation we are remembering occurred. For life is not stagnant. It is in constant motion and as fluid as water. Just because we acted one way for many years does not mean there has not been a change. Perhaps with each instance we learned something, we changed, and even though our actions were similar, perhaps we modified our actions just a little each time. Without the context, we cannot see the change clearly. We cannot see how we have changed or how others have changed in the process. So when we decide to look at a particular point in our lives, it is always helpful to remember what came before and what came after. For nothing in our life exists in a vacuum. It is all interrelated and interwoven. For we are the products of all we have lived up until this very moment. All of it matters. So next time we stop to review what happened before or what we did, it is very helpful to put it all in context to everything that surrounds it. So where in your own life do you take things out of context? How different would those things look if you put them in the proper context of all that surrounded it? So I believe I wrote this blog post after a conversation with my wife where we were talking about something that happened in the past. And she would said it was like this. I said it was like that. And I think we had a little bit of a disagreement over exactly what happened or how it unfolded. And I believe, like, we're thinking about it and talking about it. And when we kind of remembered what happened before and what happened afterwards, then it made the whole situation actually much clearer. That without the context of what was going on at the time, it was difficult to really understand what had happened. And I apologize, I can't remember exactly what it was we were talking about. But I remember that sometimes when I say something and I talk about a particular situation, when I look at it in the moment, because I now have a different context, I might shift some of the details about the way I tell the story. But when I look at, you know, really what was going on around the whole thing, it makes it easier to really see what the point was, or what the story, what I'm making of the story. And I'm sure there was something taken out of context and it didn't make sense. And once I remembered what was going on around it, it made a lot more sense. And then I noticed that in working with some of my clients, the same thing would happen, especially around things that happen in childhood. You know, we really, as we get older, we forget more and more of the details of what happened when we were younger. And when we look at what our parents did or what our siblings did, we tend to like come up with this story, and then we only remember the things that uphold our story. But when we look at the broader context, what was going on at the time, it can add more understanding to the situation. It can help things to make more sense. You know, such as like things that my father did, which actually I just found out something I might have known, but I had forgotten about, that you know, my father's first wife, after she gave birth to my brother, had postpartum depression. But what I had forgotten about my brother, I just got together with my brother and sister, that my dad at the time, he had just lost his job. And he said, you know, that could have been one of the instigating factors about why his mom had postpartum depression. And I was like, oh. And I always knew that his mom had postpartum depression. She ended up committing suicide because of it. But I didn't have that extra little piece, which now gives it more context, which now makes things more clear about what happened. And this was just this past weekend I learned about this, because, you know, my dad was forced to retire. And I remember he lost his job when I was a teenager in high school. But I didn't know about what had happened before. Or I kind of, when he said it, it sounded a little familiar. So I think he might have told me this before, but it'd been so long, I'd completely forgotten that little detail. So to me, our memory is very fickle. There are certain things we remember and a lot of things we don't remember. You know, I was just in China with my wife visiting her family, and she was stayed in her sister's place for a while and found old letters she had written from when she was, you know, a young woman, and to people and friends she couldn't even remember. She was going through stuff and telling me about it. So next time that we think that we're so sure that something happened a certain way, it might be worth our time to really look at what's the context? What was happening around that situation? Are we truly remembering the way things happened, or are we not? Are we missing that context? So that's our blog post for this week. The title of it is Context Makes Everything Clearer. And if you like my blog post, of course, you can always find it at my personally branded website at theconsciousconsultant.com or on the station's website at talkradio.nyc/blog. All right. Now, it is my extreme pleasure to welcome to the show researcher, alchemist, and author P.D. Newman. P.D. Newman has been immersed in the study and practice of shamanism, alchemy, hermeticism, and theurgy for more than two decades. He is the author of Theurgy, Theory and Practice, The Mysteries of the Ascent to the Divine, Angels in Vermilion, The Philosopher's Stone from D to DMT, and Alchemically Stoned, The Psychedelic Secret of Freemasonry. The use of hallucinogenic substances like peyote, tobacco has long played a significant role in the spiritual practices and traditions of Native Americans. While many of those practices are well documented, the relationship between ethnogens and Native Americans of the Southeast, whose psychedelic use was just as sophisticated, has gone largely unexplored. In Tripping the Trail of Ghosts, Psychedelics, and the Afterlife Journey in Native American Mound Cultures, P.D. examines these lost psychedelic traditions. Welcome to the Conscious Consultant Hour, P.D.
Thank you, Sam. Glad to be here.
A pleasure to have you. It's always nice to connect with somebody who has a deep interest in understanding where things came from. And again, I guess kind of appropriate, my blog post for this week, the context in which the culture developed. So I'm curious, like, what got you started on this path? What got you really interested in learning more about the past and different cultures and context around these esoteric topics?
Well, you know, it all started with psychedelics. As a very young man, starting around age 11, we had learned how to pick mushrooms here in the Deep South. And very quickly, we started having experiences that we had no context for, which led me to look into Eastern and Western philosophies. And from there, I really discovered the beauty and the power of ritual, and everything else just kind of fell into place. I just kind of, you know, followed my nose once I found a trail.
Wow. So, you know, when you forage for mushrooms in the wild, you really have to know what you're getting. You know, what got you kind of looking for them initially? Was it a friend that turned you on to it? Was it something you had always been interested in yourself?
My father actually taught me. Oh. And I didn't know this until years later, but there was a cow field. You know, the psilocybin cubensis grow in cow manure, so long as they're fed the proper diet. And there was a cow field next to my grandmother's house, and my brother and I had gotten up at the crack of dawn, and we're walking this field, picking mushrooms, putting them in our little Walmart bags. And I hear my uncle, my very straight uncle that does not do anything except, you know, go to the Church of Christ, hollering for us. So we kind of stash the mushrooms, and we reluctantly walk down to him. And he says, "What do y'all do in that field?" And before I could answer him, he said, "You know, you're just like your granddaddy Doherty. He used to walk that same cow field at the crack of dawn, picking Lord knows what." And that's the first time I'd ever heard about my great-grandfather Doherty. And it turns out that he was trained as an Aokiji, a medicine man in the in the local tribe, which is this was in and around Senatobia, Mississippi. But he eventually left the family and went to live with the natives. He was so immersed in the tradition. But I inherited his ledger. And it turns out that he was the healer for the town. He would heal mules and children, and he would list the herbs he'd use, but he'd use names for them that I can't identify. They'd be often in the tongue of the tribe he was working with. So I, you know, it I learned it from my father, but it seems like I got it natural. You know what I mean?
Gotcha, kind of in the genes.
Yeah.
Your great grandfather, was he part Indian, or he was just working with
He
the
was
local?
he was not. There's no Indian in our blood on either side of my family. So I don't know how he fell in with them. My grandmother doesn't remember how. It was her grandfather, so really my great great grandfather. But she doesn't remember. She's passed now, but I tried to get her to tell me everything she could about him, because the idea of an ancestor walking the same cow field that's been in this other family for generations just really sparked my imagination, you know, about how much we imagine that we have free will. And we do, of course, to an extent, but to a large degree, we're living out ancient patterns that don't always become visible immediately.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, it's time for us to take our first break. When we come back, I just want to talk a little bit about what got you started in writing, in sort of researching the psychedelics and the history of it. What got you writing books initially? And then we'll work our way up to your latest book, Tripping the Trail of Ghosts. Okay?
Sounds good.
Wonderful. So everyone, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We do this every Thursday, 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern, right here on talkradio.nyc and all over social media. And we'll be right back with our guest, P.D. Newman, author of the book, Tripping the Trail of Ghosts, in just a moment.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a high-achieving, growth-oriented leader? Are you interested in developing your authentic leadership while creating a healthy, inclusive workplace? Hi, I'm Dr. Mira Bronku, host of The Hard Skills on talkradio.nyc at 5 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays, where we discuss how leaders develop the hard skills needed to make a greater impact. We interview experts, have live coaching, and tackle these challenges. Listen to The Hard Skills on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a purpose-driven individual looking for deeper healing, clarity, and growth? Welcome to the Expansion Room, a transformative space for purpose-driven individuals. I'm Siobhan Lurice, host, licensed therapist, and coach. Join me every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Welcome back to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We're speaking this hour with P.D. Newman, author of many books, including his latest book, Tripping the Trail of Ghosts. P.D., so I'm curious. So you through psychedelics, you got interested in sort of studying about it, but what brought you to like studying about it in the past and where it came from and the context? I mean, you've written about psychedelics and Freemasonry, the Philosopher's Stone. Like, you've really dug into sort of some of the older places in which psychedelics appear. What got you interested in that aspect of it?
Well, it's really the same territory. So, like I said, really quick, I ended up in territory that I had no frame of reference for, no concept for how to discuss or make concrete, take out of the abstract. And I knew that I had found parallels in things like the Tao Te Ching and in the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads. Mm-hmm. But I'm in Mississippi. You know, there are no ashrams here. I didn't even know a Hindu or a Buddhist even, you know.
Yeah.
But I was aware of the esoteric proclivities of Freemasonry because Masonry is very visible here. It's celebrated here.
Okay.
So I never thought I would get accepted, but I petitioned and was voted with what they call elected to receive the 3 degrees. Mm-hmm. Now, shortly before this, one of the things that had thrown me into such a place that with which I was unfamiliar psychically was N,N-dimethyltryptamine, which mm-hmm. I had recently extracted from a psychoactive species of acacia. Mm-hmm. So that was what was fresh on my mind before I became a Freemason. Now, when I made it to the third degree, without going into too much detail, what is arguably the central symbol of that degree is a sprig of acacia that's associated with becoming conscious of your soul, its immortality, and its ability to go places other than be in a body. So when I saw that, I'm immediately thinking, wow, that's a coincidence, because those are exactly the things I was struggling with the DMT I experienced from the acacia. Mm. But I said, you know what, let's not fall into confirmation bias. Let's meet this symbol on its own terms and just put that out of the way for a while. And then the next thing I did, having become so impressed with the rituals of the fraternity, I began reading every version of the rituals that I can find, because they change not only by country, but they change by state, by Grand Lodge jurisdictions.
Oh, wow.
And it was long before I encountered the writings of Alessandro di Cagliostro, an alchemist who lived in the 18th century. And he wrote something called the Egyptian Rite of Freemasonry. And in his version, he has the candidate drink a red liqueur that's on the altar. And while he's drinking it, he says, this is going to raise your spirit so that you may understand what's about to follow in a different way, which is about as close as you can get with the linguistic limitations to saying, this is going to expand your consciousness, right? And change your perception. And then as he's drinking it, he tells him that this is the philosopher's stone that you're drinking. It's from the primal matter. And he says the primal matter is nothing but the acacia that you received in the ordinary degree of Master Mason. So he's telling him he's drinking a psychoactive concoction of acacia. And that's what drove me to write, because I thought this has been lost for 300 years. If I don't write it down, it might never get written down. And I was, you know, terrified I'd get ejected from the fraternity. You know, I didn't know what would happen. Everything went great, you know, and it went over well with the brethren in my lodge. That's how I started writing and how I began exploring not just Masonry, but ascent motifs in various traditions, soul ascent models, and the mechanism that was relied on to affect those ascents.
And I know that they found recently that in some ancient Roman or ancient Greek clay pots, they found evidence of ergo, which is the mold that grows on rye that LSD was extracted from. So I know there's a lot of theories that the use of psychedelics in the West, not just in the indigenous cultures in South America, where we know it goes back at least 3,000 years, but in the West, that there's also indications that psychedelic use has been present for
That's absolutely
thousands
right.
of years. I'm curious because you've taken a very, in your first couple of books, a very Western approach to it. How far back have you found evidence or indications that there might have been use of psychoactive plants going back how far?
Well, if we accept Kluver's idea, Kluver, he was injecting himself with mescaline eventually. First, he was taking peyote, but he was charting the phenomenology of the visual aspect of it. And he arrived at these four geometric motifs that he calls form constants. And eventually, an archaeologist, Lewis Williams, postulated that these constitute the first in his three stages of trance model. So it's inherent in psychedelics, especially serotonergics, anything like LSD, psilocybin, DMT, mescaline. So if we are looking for variations on his form constants in ancient art, then that we could take that, and it has been taken as evidence that psychedelic use goes back to the dawn of man, qua man. Back to the very earliest days, which makes sense. It's only natural that if something was stumbled upon that opened the world in a way, opened it like a door and allowed them to see, we can only speculate about how they would have interpreted it, but there's no question that they would push that button again and again, have someone else, hey, come here, push this button, tell me what happens. I think it would be the only thing worth exploring once you got your hands on something like fire and a blade,
Me and some of my friends, we kind of jokingly refer to the burning bush as an acacia bush, and
It is. It is.
which was an acacia bush, and how Moses' father or father-in-law was an acacia tree farmer, I
Yeah, when it
think.
says burning bush, the actual words are leba sena, which means glowing acacia. Sena is Hebrew for acacia, and it's even the root word for Sinai. So when he encounters the fire on Mount Sinai, it's like a fractal of the bush, but the word is taken from the same thing. So when he comes down and it says that he was horned, in the King James Version, it's translated as he had rays of light coming off of his face. But the actual word is a word that means he had horns coming off of his face, which is very similar to how indigenous shamans will make themselves consubstantial with the sacrament. They'll dress up as the Amanita Muscaria, right? He's coming down with thorns. And in Greek, what we think about Jesus with the crown of thorns, what it says is a crown of acanthanon. Acanthus is acacia, is that's why they call it acacia, because it's thorned. So it's inherent in the language itself.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. It's so funny how all of this stuff is like right there in front of us, but unless you know to look for it, you don't see these subtle connections to these different plants and in these different cultures. So that's
That's right.
really fascinating. I want to take our next break now. And when we come back, I want to start getting into tripping the trail of ghosts and the things that you found out about the Native Americans in your neck of the woods in Mississippi and in the Southeast, because you found out some pretty interesting things that I don't think are very commonly known.
Let's do it.
All right. So everyone, please stay tuned. You are listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We're speaking this hour with P.D. Newman, author of the book, Tripping the Trail of Ghosts, Psychedelics and the Afterlife Journey in a Native American Mound Cultures. And we will be right back to get into the book.
Misalignment within your sales team or with a client stalls deals and creates unnecessary friction for you and the client, resulting in up to 37% lower win rate. If you're in pre-sales, sales, sales management, or sales enablement, and you'd like to increase revenues, win rate, margins, client satisfaction, and stay competitive, this show is for you. Hi, I'm Art Fromm, host of the Making Seamless Sales Show. Please join me live Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the Nonprofit Sector Connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
Hi, I'm Linda Marsanico. The A-Train to Sedona is a memoir about my journey to love and compassion. It's also the name of my new broadcast on Wednesdays at 12 noon. When we are spiritual, we embrace possibilities and ideas, which strengthen our mind, body, spirit, health, and wisdom. On the A-Train to Sedona broadcast, I plan to interview guests who embrace these expansive practices. Join us on Wednesdays at 12 noon on Talk Radio New York City.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
So, PD, your latest book is called Tripping the Trail of Ghosts, Psychedelics and the Afterlife Journey in Native American Mound Cultures. And this book is more focused on the local indigenous cultures around Mississippi and in the Southeast. What got you to decide to focus on that for your latest book?
That's a good question. So, the book I had published previously was my book on theurgy, which is a ritual application of Platonic metaphysics. And in this, they have a model of soul ascent where they imagine that there are portals in certain constellations, and the soul can go through those portals to access the Milky Way, which is, ever since the days of Pythagoras, is where they say that the souls prior to and after incarnation orbit this Milky Way. So I was telling, I was at a conference in Yorkshire called the Tearingham Initiative, and Brian Murarescu, the author of The Immortality Key, he was there, and he has a classical education. So I was telling him about my book on theurgy and exactly what I just told you. And nearby us were Dennis McKenna and Graham Hancock having a private discussion, but they were close enough to be an earshot of what Brian and I were discussing. And Graham turned around and he said, "Oh, you're talking about the path of souls." And I said, "No, I'm talking about theurgy, Neoplatonic ritual application of Platonic metaphysics, you know." And he says, "Well, everything you just said is exactly what happens in the path of souls model, this afterlife journey inherent in Southeastern Native Americans." And I said, "Well, then I got to know more about that." And so before I even came home, I got on Amazon and found this book by a man, Gregory Little, brilliant guy that just happened to be an hour from me in Memphis, Tennessee. So by the time I got home, the book was there. I read it. I was blown away. And what really caught my attention were all of the places that needed to be investigated further to determine whether or not psychedelics were involved, because there were a lot of clues that there were. And that's what really started me down this journey, was was, first off, how can these two models be the same if there's no known communication between the isolationism argument we get from mainstream archaeology? The Greeks never talked to the Native Americans in the Southeast. Right. How can the models be the same? So that was the first interesting thing. The second was studying the botanical assemblages recovered from the mound sites and just being taken aback by the number of psychoactive compounds that all of these mound sites had in common. And it opened an entire domain of research that has really just been neglected, I think, mainly because nobody knows to look at it. They just assume we know what they were up to. And like you said in the introduction, you know, when we think about Native Americans and psychoactive plants, our brain goes to peyote and tobacco. Now, peyote didn't make it to the Southeast until
because it's a desert later. Plant. Yeah,
right. It was a Southwestern native practice in the Southeast. So what were they using? Well, they were using tobacco. They were using Nicotiana rustica, but what also was uncovered and that was really fascinating is they have this ritual practice. It's called black drink. Cassina is the common word they would use. Some of the tribes would use, not all of them, but it's also called black drink. And it's made from a species of holly, the yaupon holly, which is Ilex vomitoria. Now, the botanists classified it as vomitoria because the natives were observed drinking it and vomiting and drinking it again and vomiting. Uh-huh. And so my initial thought was, well, it must be an emetic, but I won't know unless I try it. Uh-huh. And it grows all around our lake out here. So I harvested it, roasted the leaves, made several batches of varying concentrations, drank various amounts. It's the only native source of caffeine in North America. So it'll give you caffeine jitters, but at no point did it act as an emetic. I never felt nauseous. So that raised the question of why are they vomiting after drinking it? And that's when I found that the recipe changed based on the context in which they were drinking it. And that opened the door to saying, okay, what else were they boiling with the Ilex vomitoria? And the most fascinating answer was the roots of Gleditsia triacanthos, which was previously classified as Acacia americana. Mm-hmm. Now, given my previous research into Freemasonry, I thought, they're boiling the roots of an acacia. The roots are where the molecule or the alkaloid occurs in most of these trees. And Gleditsia triacanthos grows all around here. But it's puzzling because its distribution far exceeds what should be natural. All of the animals that fed on these trees, on the seed pods, and thus spread them, are extinct. They have no animals feeding on them for thousands of years. And yet, in the South East, their distribution is so dense that we know that it's because the natives were cultivating them intentionally. And so this led to me thinking, okay, well, if they have the DMT, where's the MAOI? Because when we're talking about ayahuasca, we need an MAOI in most cases, not every case, because some trees like Jerema Prada, the Mimosa hostilis, there are ways to prepare it without it that's active. But in most cases, I need to prove that there's an MAOI. Yeah. And among these botanical assemblages were Passiflora incarnata, passion flower, which contains harmine. So we know they had that. Nicotiana rustica, their tobacco, contains monoamine oxidase inhibitors. And then the big clincher was that the black drink itself, the yaupon holly, is a cousin to yerba mate, which has monoamine oxidase inhibitors in it. So mixing these plants, which we have ample evidence that they were, would result in a nearly identical analog to ayahuasca, yet it's in southeastern North America, beginning around 1000 AD. You know, it changes everything we thought we knew about the natives in this area.
Right. And isn't that fascinating that even though it's a different combination of plants of what they use in South America, but it's something that creates the same kind of experience. And so while we tend to think of ayahuasca as a purely South American concoction, that there are analogs to it in North America as well.
Right. Right. And if it's something they had inherited from South America, because we know that cacao, chocolate, mm-hmm. we know that mm-hmm. it made it all the way up from South America mm-hmm. into Chaco Valley in Southwest North mm-hmm. of North America.
Right.
So we know that things can get from there to here. Mm-hmm. But if this had been something that had come from there, we would expect to see Psychotria viridis or Diplopteris cabrana or Banisteriopsis copy, all these plants they use in South America to produce ayahuasca, we would expect to see them here, but we don't. So just like their afterlife model, it seems to be an independent discovery of something that raises the question of, are we dealing with, you know, objective truths here that we've just completely lost sight of as we focus more and more on positivism and materialism and etc. You know,
have you been able to talk with any descendants of the tribe to see if there's any oral tradition around this?
Well, we have evidence in the Bureau of Ethnology's reports from the Smithsonian, where they would speak to natives then and they would tell stories. And a number of these stories involve them taking the roots of the honey locust and boiling them in a big pot. And they had a ball game that they mm-hmm. would play that influenced our modern ball games. Mm-hmm. Before they played, they would take the roots and chew them mm-hmm. and spit the juice out and rub it on their bodies. Now, the DMT isn't orally active, remember, but it mm-hmm. is absorbable transdermally, and they would spit the juices and rub it all over their bodies before playing this ball game. So there are lots of incidents in the ethnographies. The only native that I've spoken with is an elder of the Omaha, and I believe he's an elder of two different tribes, but his name's Taylor Keene. He published a book with inner traditions on Turtle Island, the prehistorical myths of North America. And he fully ascribes to what I'm saying. He says that there is a lot of evidence now that these things have survived, but the contexts have changed. Like Datura was being used by them in conjunction with these other plants to cause out-of-body experiences as a way to train them how to get to the path of souls in a psychedelic way, right? But he says they still use Datura, but not in that way. They use it more to heal, like as a poultice, which it's very effective that way for bruising and sprains. So they still have a lot of it. But just like with anything, the context changes over time with the cultural values.
Yeah. Wow. I like have so many questions swirling around in my mind. It's hard to limit them because we don't have a lot of time. So this is an things that you found locally, and as you mentioned, the trees are not indigenous, or the animals that would spread the seeds of the trees are not around. Haven't been around for a long time, but there's tons of the trees around, and nobody has found this connection before. There hasn't been anyone to look at the fauna of the area and wonder, like, why is this the case?
There's been one researcher that I know of that has noted the odd distribution of the plants, and he came to the same conclusion that these must have been cultivated for some reason. but he didn't have that answer.
Right.
Now, the thing with Gladitzia triacanthos having the tryptamine alkaloid in it, it's not widely known because it's not published in any research journal. It's not in any academic studies. It was only published in one source that if you weren't already running and reading in psychedelic circles, you wouldn't know about. But it was a man who called himself Keeper of the Trout. And he published a book called Some Simple Tryptamines. And he was a scientist. And he had he noticed the similarity between things like Mimosa hostilis, between acacia species and Anadenanthera species that produce the Yopo, the snuff, DMT snuff.
Yeah,
they had
all
had the same the same pinnate compound leaf structure. So he noticed that and started saying, well, let's look at other species that have the same pinnate compound leaf structure and we'll assay it. He chemically tested it and found that DMT was in the roots. So that's the only place it's published. So unless you know to look there, the other academic researchers wouldn't know to ask that question. But of course, I believe in testing it. Take it to the bench. Find out. So, you know, one of the first things on my list was to let's try to reproduce it, just like I did with the black drink. Let's test it. And I quickly found that 10 grams of the root bark paired with roughly 25 grams of passion flower is enough to elicit a full-on ayahuasca-like experience. It was profound, visionary, and quite frankly, scary at moments. But that's what you expect. You want it tests your limits. It takes you beyond your comfort zone. But it's absolutely effective.
Wow. Okay, it's time for us to take our last break of the show. But when we come back, I want to circle back around to the Trail of Ghosts or the Path of Souls and sort of how does all this psychedelic use tie back into sort of the spiritual nature of the indigenous cultures and how it all works together, okay?
Sounds great.
Wonderful. So everyone, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, and we'll be right back to wrap it all up with our guest, P.D. Newman, in just a moment.
On Frank About Health, we're not just talking healthcare. We're managing disruption and innovation. Over the last 4 years, I've taken you from epilepsy and COVID to mental health, caregiving, and now the front lines of healthcare transformation. Stay tuned for a healthier future as we bring on the innovators, professionals, storytellers, and advocates who show you how to own your healthcare every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Ready to serve up success with a splash? Hi, I'm Bruce Kramer, a.k.a. the Corporate Cockroach.
I'm the Renaissance Woman, Angie Snowball.
And I'm your strategy doctor, Dr. Navtej Dasanjh, inviting you to serving up success with a splash.
Join us as we shake things up with real talk and real strategies centered around awareness, action, and accountability.
And yes, there really is a cocktail involved. Please join us and sip your way to success.
Serving up success with a splash, where wisdom meets happy hours. Cheers!
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
So, PD, the name of your most recent book is Tripping the Trail of Ghosts. And you mentioned before about the Path of Souls. So what is the Trail of Ghosts? And how does all these psychedelic brews relate to sort of the spiritual practices of the indigenous cultures?
That's another good question. So the Trail of Ghosts is just another name that is applied to the path of souls. They both refer to the Milky Way as this road that souls walk. Now, among the Southeastern natives, the Mississippians, this wasn't common knowledge. This was initiated wisdom. So the chief, the medicine man, we could call him, the nobles, they were initiated into what's known as a sodality, a secret society that taught this. So not everyone would get to go on the path of souls and lead to the equivalent of the happy hunting ground, right? In the other realm. And the way they would teach this was by degrees, very similar to Freemasonry. Each degree of teaching covered a certain amount of territory on the path. So you didn't get it all at once. You got it over time. And the level at which you were was carved into sometimes a gorget, a shell carved image. Also, they would drink this brew from large lightning whelk shells, and the images would be carved on these shells. And we know that from the ethnographies that these shells were buried with their possessors because they quite literally identified with them. This is the my level of knowledge. And it also spoke to the other people in the tribe. They know this is your rank in a society I don't belong to. Right. Mm-hmm. Kind of like when somebody says, oh, he's a 33rd degree Mason, but they're not a Mason, but they still have this suspicion, this respect, this, you know, fascination with that person. It's very similar to that. The way they taught it was using the mound sites themselves. We know from researchers that have paired stories of, say, Makwa Manito and the Ojibwe. Makwa is this bear divinity that brought them these sacred packs that contained all of the things they needed to perform certain rituals. And his journey is a sacred journey that they imitate ritually. And it was discovered that the mound sites, many of them, the landmarks are all in the same place to where Bear's journey took what he encountered mythically that they reenact. So the mound sites become a virtual training ground for the path of souls itself. But it wasn't just a ritual they performed. It was used in conjunction with these psychedelics so that they would also have firsthand experience of what it's like to be sometimes outside of your body, sometimes, you know, to be immersed in both places at once. But that's how they would use it. And it wasn't until much later when Moundville in Alabama became a necropolis. Natives from all over the Southeast would travel hundreds, thousands of miles to bring their dead there. And it's because the sodality had opened their doors in a way to allow other people, even though they hadn't been initiated, to get on the path of souls. We see something similar in ancient Egypt, right? Where only the Pharaoh is the one that travels up because he has the pyramid text. Unas has the secret in the pyramid. But by the time anybody got in that pyramid, they copied that down into coffin texts. And then anybody who could afford it could have the same thing painted on the inside of their coffin. And then we get the books of the dead. If you can afford it, you can have one, right? So it's kind of like that. For a fee, one of these individuals that were initiated into the path of souls and the trials, because you had various beings you encountered, and similar to Gnosticism, you had to know what to do to get past them. So they would act as a psychopomp. You know, the family would bring the remains of their deceased relative or friend, pay these shamans to enact this ritual, and go with them to make sure their soul made it on the path of souls.
Wow. This is such a fascinating topic. I could talk with you about this for days. Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of the show. I'm just curious, are you already on to your next research topic? Are you working on your next book already?
I am. I'm working on three books.
Wow.
One of them is a follow-up to my Theurgy book, which is more of a look at a program of reading that would accompany the practice of Theurgy in ancient times, in late antiquity. Mm-hmm. I'm working on a book on the Tarot de Marseille, the variations of the old Italian French tarot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got a third book that is looking at the references and applications of these various same psychoactive compounds in the grimoires and the magical grimoires tradition, uh-huh, as a way to try and understand how they were obtaining certain results and whether or not it's consistent with the phenomenology of that particular substance they're using in that context.
Gotcha. Wow. Fascinating. Fascinating. All right. We'll definitely have you come back on this show when you get those books out to talk about them. Okay, PD?
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. If people want to, I know you're Tripping the Trail of Ghosts is available at all major booksellers. Do you have your own website if people want to learn more about you and your work?
I have one being prepared. I have a consulting company called Helios Consulting LLC, and I'll use that to also post research papers, but it's in the works. If anybody wants to reach out to me, you can reach me under PD Newman at all the social media platforms. I really just, talk about what I'm researching, and I rarely get to talk about it. So if you got any questions, feel free to reach out.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, PD, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come on board. I really look forward to reading your book and learning more about all of this. I find it so incredibly fascinating.
Thank you, Sam.
And of course, thank you, my loyal listeners, for tuning in each week. I did see Steel Media commenting on YouTube. Oh, really? I think we kind of shocked them. But thank you for tuning in each week. Without you, there is no show. And don't forget, if you did miss any part of today's show, you can always catch the replay on talkradio.nyc and all over social media on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Twitch. Thank you all for tuning in. We will talk to you all next week.